Let me add my welcome to the other Andrews, and welcome to you if you're here for the first time. I'm afraid I've got quite a serious announcement to make at this point of the service. Maybe it's just why a few things have been going wrong because we're a little bit on edge. But you probably know, or you might not know if you're just new today, that there's quite a lot of people who are opposed to the work of Grace Church Greenwich, and they quite like to close it down, and we face various enemies as a church. And I'm afraid to have to say to you today that we've discovered that somebody within the church family who's well known to us and well known to all of us here is actually working for those opponents, those enemies, been feeding them various information, and their plot is reaching a climax. And I need to tell you about that very soberly this afternoon. A couple of you are smiling because you see what I'm doing, and others of us are feeling a little bit tense. And I think that is the right frame of mind as we come to this reading. So it's on page 900. It really is on page 900. And it'll help you if you can follow along. Page 900. Jesus has just washed his disciples' feet. And then he says this in verse 18, right at the bottom of the left-hand column of page 900. I'm not speaking of all of you. I know whom I've chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I'm telling you this now before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever receives the one I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. After saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit and testified, truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. The disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. One of his disciples, whom Jesus loved, was reclining at the table at Jesus' side. So Simon motioned to him to ask Jesus who he was speaking about. So that disciple, leaning back against Jesus, said to him, Lord, who is it? Jesus answered, it is he to whom I'll give this morsel of bread when I've dipped it. So when he dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. Then after he'd taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, what you're going to do, do quickly. Now, no one at the table knew why he said this to him. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, buy what we need for the feast, or that he should give something to the poor. So after receiving the morsel of bread, he immediately went out, and it was night. The night in question is Thursday night. It's quite an eventful night, as it turns out. Jesus spends the rest of the evening upstairs in a room with now 11 of his disciples. Judas has left, and he teaches them what it will be like when he's gone. We've called this sermon series, When I'm Gone, after the pop song. And then later on Thursday night, soldiers arrive with Judas. He gives the sign. He kisses Jesus. They move to arrest him. They take him off, and the trial goes on through the night. And then in the next morning, Jesus is crucified. Thursday night, and the most famous betrayal of history. And we're going to look at it today. And you'll see in these cards, these new autumn program cards, we try to give you the passage every week we can look at. You'll see we're going all the way through these chapters of what happened the night before Jesus died. And we've given a title to each one. And the title for today is really wrong. It's rubbish. I read a couple of weeks ago before I understood the passage. And I said, when I'm gone, fear no evil. That's the title. And that is almost the opposite of the real title. So it should be, when I'm gone, fear evil. Right, so this is exactly wrong, in keeping with many other things in today's service. Be quite afraid of evil. In fact, be quite afraid of Judas. It's just a famous word now, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people in our culture don't know the Bible very well, but even people who don't know anything about the Christian story know that the word Judas is not a nice thing to call someone. Like the name Adolf, it's gone kind of out of fashion shortly after this particular guy with that name. To be a Judas means to stab somebody in the back, to betray somebody close to you. And this is the original Judas doing a Judas. And we're going to see that it is a warning for us that we don't do the same. See, here's the scary thing about Judas. Judas who betrayed Jesus. You'll see on the inside of the service sheet, there's some points so you can follow along what I'm saying. And keep your passage open and look down at the verse numbers and then you can see the outline. What betrayal tells us about Judas? A warning. Here's the first bit of the warning. Number one, he was an insider. Judas was an insider of insiders. He was one of the 12, one of Jesus' closest band. Jesus had crowds following him, the feeding of the 5,000. There were over 5,000 people. But there was a particular group of his closest followers, just 12 of them, and Judas was in the inner circle, an insider of insiders. Judas was one of the people that Jesus had just washed his feet, and that amazing demonstration of Jesus' love and willingness to forgive and to save and to cleanse. And Jesus had said, you are clean, but not every one of you, because there was somebody around the table but taking part in the foot washing who actually was quite filthy on the inside, even as he was being washed. He was one of the disciples. And I think that's frightening, because we think that the greatest enemies of the church will come from outside, but always they come from inside. It was that way in the beginning, and it's been that way throughout history. And the greatest enemies to Grace Church Greenwich could be here amongst us. They could be the people who lead the Christian Union. They could be the people who lead the church. They could be the people who lead the denomination. They will be the people who look like insiders, Christians. You'd never think that one of them. And in fact, nobody did think it was one of them. He was an insider, but number two on the sheet, nobody knew. None of the peers knew. So when Jesus says, one of you will betray me, I mean, you could cut the atmosphere with a knife. It's very tense. And they start whispering to each other, who is it? They don't know who he's talking about. It's just a bombshell. And I think, again, the really frightening thing is that I guess Judas is the one person who does know who it is, right? He's already got the plan to betray Jesus, and he's made the arrangements with the enemies of Jesus. But he plays along with it. Oh, who could it be? Me? You? Nobody guesses. Nobody suspects him. And so Peter motions to John, who calls himself the disciple that Jesus loves. He kind of asks him, you're closest. And John leans over and says, Jesus, who is it? And Jesus says, I'll give him a piece of bread. It's the guy who I give the bit of bread. And he dips it. And you can imagine John's eyes absolutely transfixed on this piece of bread. It dips in the wine. And then where's it going to go? And he passed it over to Judas. And Jesus says to Judas, what you're going to do, do quickly. And everyone hears him say that, but no one knows what he means. Because actually only John has seen the special signal. And everyone else has said, well, what's Judas got to do? Oh, maybe it's because he's the treasurer. So he keeps the money bag. And maybe they need to go and buy some food for the meal that we're going to have later. Or maybe it's we got some charity money to give away to the poor. I suppose it must be that. No, it's a betrayal about to happen in their midst, but no one even knows. An insider, a surprise to everyone. And maybe even now, this is a pretty scary passage for you, because you're here at church, so by definition, you're a kind of insider. I mean, there's people at Trinity Laban who aren't at church today, and there's people at University of Greenwich who aren't meeting with Christians, and there's but you're here because you're on the inside, kind of, with Jesus. And yet maybe you know, nobody else knows, but maybe you know that you're starting to slip away from Jesus. Maybe you know you're not really on Jesus' side. And no one would guess. But it turns out it's not totally out the blue. Judas, number three on the sheet, he was already compromising with sin. Back in chapter 12, we hear about a woman who wastes a load of perfume, really expensive perfume, and smashes the jar and pours it all over Jesus' feet. And it's because she loves Jesus and because she knows Jesus is about to die. And Judas is a bit cross about this. He says, you could have sold this perfume for more than 300 denarii. A denarius was a day's wage. So 300 denarii is almost a year's wage. So what's the average wage in the UK? It's like £30,000 or something like that. £30,000 worth of perfume. That is a lot of perfume. And this woman, she loves Jesus and says she doesn't think anything of smashing the perfume and pouring it all over Jesus. And Jesus is a bit annoyed. That's a waste, he says. And then John just steps us in and says, oh, by the way, don't think that Judas is being like really sort of caring about the poor here. Just look down the little verse I printed for you. He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. And again, no one knows that, right? So in this passage, we're now another chapter later, and when Jesus says, what you're about to do quickly, they think, oh, it must be about the money. Maybe he's going about to sign off an expense for lunch or give some money away. No one knows that he dips his hand in the till. But I guess it's been going on for a while. There's a sort of public appearance as a Christian, and then meanwhile hidden, there's a quite a different lifestyle altogether. He was already compromising. And number four, the devil was already at work in him. Here's the scary thing about John. He's very explicit that there really are evil forces at work, and indeed an evil being who's at work in this world. He doesn't just blame the devil and then Judas is off the hook, because Judas' own heart has decided to do these things. But at the same time as the human decision he makes, there is a supernatural evil at work in him. And it's kind of progressive. It kind of goes step by step by step. So at the beginning of the chapter, verse 2, during supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, stage 1. And then stage 2, after he'd taken the morsel of bread, Satan entered into him. This kind of verse can really scare Christians. They ask questions like, can I be demon-possessed? Could the devil kind of take over my body and make me do something I don't want to do? And, you know, this is sort of informed by various horror movies you might have seen. And the answer is no, the devil doesn't work like that in Christians. He can't suddenly overpower you, but he can tempt you and lead you further. And then further goes to further, further. Goes to further, further, further. And it's that progression he puts into his heart. Here's an idea, Judas. You like money quite a lot, don't you? You occasionally dip your hand into the till. You could get a lot more money. Jesus isn't really working out, is he? The way you thought, this new Jesus movement, it's not as popular as you hoped. Hasn't brought the revelation you were hoping for. Jesus, it's time to cut loose. And you could do so very profitably. And the temptation leads to further, leads to further, leads to further. And then suddenly Judas is completely taken over by the evil one for evil purposes. The devil was at work in him. And then the last verse of our section, verse 30, after receiving this little bit of bread, he immediately went out. He slips away. John knows because Jesus has given him the sign. No one else knows, but Jesus sort of makes his excuses and shuffles out. And suddenly it's nighttime. Now, John's gospel, you might know, is all about light and darkness. It starts right in the beginning of chapter 1 by saying that Jesus was the true light that gives light to everyone who's coming into the world. Jesus, the light in a world that is dark. And as we go through John, we find out that Jesus brings light, but people who want to do dodgy stuff, they hide in the shadows. I remember when I used to do summer camps in a boarding school in Somerset. I won't tell you which one because it's a horrible story. But one night, I can't remember why, but I ended up going downstairs in the middle of the night. Maybe I was hungry and wanted to raid the larder or something. I don't know. But anyway, I turned the light on and the whole of the ground floor was covered with cockroaches everywhere. And literally, I turned on the light and then there was a click, scuttle. And then it looked fine again. I mean, so once the light's on, you can't see the cockroaches, because they hide from the light. So you have to catch them unawares. But it was a pretty disgusting sight. And I never, the next day I knew they were there even though I couldn't see them. And Jesus says something a little bit like that. And I've given you the quote in chapter 3 down on the sheet. Jesus says, "This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, but people loved the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. Everyone who does wicked things hates the light and doesn't come into the light lest his work should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes into the light so that it may be clearly seen his works are being carried out in God." You'd think that everyone would be really pleased that Jesus come, but John explains, oh no, some people aren't very pleased about Jesus because Jesus kind of shows you up and Jesus kind of shines the spotlight on you. And when you compare yourself against his perfect life, it just makes you feel a bit guilty about your own sins and own faults. And so one approach is to come clean with Jesus, to come into the light and say, "Jesus, I'm dirty. I need to be cleaned. I need you to forgive me and to wash me." It's what we try and do every week with a confession at the beginning of the service, to be honest with God. But the other option is just to hide from the spotlight, like the cockroach, to go into the shadows, to go into hiding. And that's the option that Judas takes here. "One of you will betray me," he said. Judas, I suppose, could have said, "Geez, I'm so sorry. That was a temptation for me. In fact, the devil had been whispering it to me and I was quite attracted to it. And actually, there was money promised and I've got to tell you, I've been helping myself to some of the money for some time now. Please, will you forgive me? Please, can there be a way back?" And I guess what we know about Jesus is there would be a way back, always a way back. And yet instead of coming into the light, Judas slips into the shadows and it's night. I was looking up light and darkness verse in John. I found loads of them. And it just seemed that every one of them was a choice. So I printed them all for you on the sheets. Just look at these light and dark verses. Chapter 8, Jesus spoke to them saying, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." You see, you've got a choice. You can either walk in the shadows and no one will know what you're up to, or you can make a stand to identify yourself with Jesus and come clean with him and walk in the light. And again, Judas chooses at this point to walk in the darkness. He can't walk with Jesus. I remember someone saying, as they're whistling that catchy little tune, "The Sunny Side of the Street," they said, if I want to walk down the sunny side of the street, actually I don't because I get sunburnt quite easily, but if you want to walk down the sunny side of the street and I want to walk in the shadows, we can't walk together. And that's Jesus' point. You've got to choose. I'm in the light. You can walk with me in the light, or you can walk in the darkness. Jesus walks in the darkness. He makes a choice. Then in chapter 11, it becomes a bit more urgent. Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he doesn't stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the night is not in him." Jesus is saying, watch out. You walk around at night time and you're going to come a cropper. It's very dangerous to walk around at night time. And of course that's true. If you've ever been walking in absolute pitch darkness, the closest I've got to that is being in a cave and you go down one of these caves with stalactites, stalagmites, whatever, and then they always do the party trick where they say, okay, in a minute we're going to turn the lights off and you won't be able to see anything. And they turn the lights off and there's literally no light at all and you can't see anything in front of your face. Imagine they were then to say, right, now find your way out of the cave. And health and safety wouldn't allow it, would they? Because there'd be a lot of people falling flat on their face. It's very dangerous to be in the night. You stumble, but Judas goes into the night. And then verse 12, chapter 12, "The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest the darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness doesn't know where he's going. While you have the light, believe in the light that you may become sons of light." But then Judas, he chooses the darkness. If you are tempted to do a Judas, let me ask you, where do you think you're going to go if you're not with Jesus? Maybe some of you are at a crossroads. I see lots of people here for the first time at university. It's great to welcome you. Grace Church Greenwich, people from Trinity, people from University of Greenwich, maybe others as well. And university, it is a decision time point of life. Lots of people who've been part of a Christian family, maybe, and you've grown up going to church, and for the first time, you've got your own decisions to make. No one's going to know where you go on Sunday. Your parents won't wake you up in the morning, or in our case, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which gives a little bit of a lie-in potential. But no one's going to know if you don't come, or if gradually, little by little, you put a bit of distance between yourself and your Christian upbringing. The decisions you make at university, you could make less Christian ones without the same sort of hassle that you would have got at home. And it can be a time when many people who started as Christians give up as Christians. I want to say that quite frankly to you. In fact, last year we had a kind of discouraging year at Grace Church. We had loads of freshers in the first month. And some of them just slipped away. I don't think they were going to other churches. I think they were going to no churches. And then gradually, less and less walking with Jesus. It could easily happen, and you're at a crossroads. Will my university days be days walking in the light? And if you're thinking of slipping away, let me ask you where you would go instead as Judas just slips away. Jesus warns him, if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles. Very dangerous. Easily fall on your face. Easily do yourself great harm. If anyone walks in the darkness, he doesn't know where he's going. And people know how to have fun at university, but not many people know where they're going. What is life about? Where is the future headed? Where am I going to be in 1,000 years' time? What happens when we die? What is life for? There's massive questions Jesus got the answer to. No one else has the answer to them. Beware of betraying Jesus. And we are all candidates for it, because we're insiders. Maybe some of us have begun already down that track and nobody else knows. Maybe little compromises with sin, maybe little compromises with Satan, maybe his temptations have begun to get a grip of you more and more and more. And then Jesus issues the invitation. There's a choice. You can come clean, come into the light, live clearly for Jesus, receive the forgiveness he offers, or gradually slip into the shadows. So you see why the title's wrong. I said fear no evil, and the point is be very afraid of evil. Be very conscious of the danger of evil. What betrayal tells us about Judas? But then secondly, and this is much happier and very wonderful actually, what betrayal tells us about Jesus? And I hope you are going to love Jesus more as a result of what we're about to see. Because I certainly do, having looked at it this week, and I hope that you will as well. What betrayal tells us about Jesus? Number one, he knew about it. Nobody else knew about it apart from Judas, and I guess the enemies that Judas had made a pact with, and I guess the devil, but none of the disciples know, but Jesus knows. Look again at verse 18. Jesus says, I'm not speaking to all of you, I know whom I've chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I'm telling you this now before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am. Jesus already knows, and he's known for some time. Back in chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus says to the disciples, I chose you, the 12, yet one of you is a devil. And amazingly, that comment seems to pass unnoticed. No one says, what? They're just very rude. And who? It almost made it so extreme, they think they've misheard. And so it just sort of goes dormant for a few chapters. And then again, in chapter 13, as he's washing their feet, he says, the one who's bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you. And again, the comment goes unnoticed. But one of us is dirty, Jesus. No, they don't spot it. So unexpected. He knew who was going about to betray him. That's why he said, not all of you are clean. And then now he says it explicitly, one of you will betray me. He knows that. Now, what does that tell us about Jesus? Well, it tells us he's not caught unawares by some brilliant plot. It's not like the chief priests and the Pharisees outwitted Jesus, managed to recruit a double agent unknown to Jesus. He knows all that is going on. And that tells us that Jesus is in control of what is happening. Notice he says in verse 19, I'm telling you this now before it takes place, so that when it does take place, you may believe that I am. In other words, if Jesus hadn't predicted it in advance, it might seem like Jesus was losing control. And this is something that happens quite often in the Bible. When something bad's about to happen, God quite often tells you about it in advance so that you know that it wasn't that God lost control. So an example would be back in the Old Testament when Israel gets invaded and conquered by this other country called Babylon. And if it just happened without being told about it in advance, you would think, oh, Babylon must be more powerful than Israel, and Babylonian gods must be more powerful than the Christian God. And the real God, the Christian God, he doesn't want you to think that, so he tells them in advance, you are about to be conquered by Babylon. And in fact, it's going to happen because I'm going to allow it to happen. I'm in charge of it happening. And you know that I'm in charge of it happening because I can tell you the future. Andrew and I were laughing about this because there's a comedy show, which I still can't remember, that you watch. But it happens in quite a lot of shows. You know when somebody trips or something, or they do something stupid, and they say, oh, I knew that was going to happen. Well, that was deliberate. And it kind of obviously isn't deliberate. So, you know, you're walking along and then you do something totally stupid and then you try and pass it off as if it was a dance move or something like that. Well, Jesus doesn't want us to think that he's trying to sort of recover from something that called him out. So he tells us in advance. He knows about it. Number two, he knows about it and it upsets him. It troubles him. In other words, Jesus, yes, he's God. Yes, he knows the future. But I think sometimes we can think of Jesus as God in a way that we diminish the fact that he's a real human being. So we say it must be easy for Jesus because he was totally in control of everything in the whole universe. Every atom was obeying him, etc. And so going to die on the cross, it must have just been, you know, his plan. He follows it step by step. And this just reminds us, even though it's his plan, even though he knows, he's troubled. Upset, scared. It's to know somebody amongst your closest friends is about to stab you in the back is pretty horrible. And Jesus quotes from this psalm, I think partly so that we understand how horrible it is for him. It's Psalm 41. We can find it again on page 469. And it describes somebody who's having a really horrible time. As Andy said, it's King David originally who writes it. And he's been betrayed by actually one of his children. He wants to kill him. And he's on the run. And it's the knowledge that people want bad things to happen to you. That there's enemies all around you. They're hoping for your end. So verse 5, my enemy is saying malice. When will he die? That's what people want to happen to you. But when they come to you, verse 6, when one comes to see me, he utters empty words while his heart gathers iniquity. When he goes out, he tells it abroad. Now, this is a bit of a tricky verse. Let me explain. I think what's going on is when he talks to me, he says sort of trivial, nice things, empty things, sort of nothing. It's like, oh, you're looking nice today, Andrew, and I like the way you've done your hair. And is that a new shirt? And they just sort of say empty things. But meanwhile, in their heart, they're plotting all kinds of evil things. And when they leave the room, they tell everyone else all the evil things. So it's this feeling you can't really trust anybody because what they say to your face isn't the same as what they're saying about you behind your back. And David knows that and Jesus knows that. Here's Judas who says nice things, empty things to my face and plotting behind my back. All who hate me whisper about me. They imagine the worst for me. They say a deadly thing is poured out on him. He won't rise again from where he lies. Even my close friend, whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. To be betrayed by a friend, to have somebody who says lovely things to you, to your face, but then as soon as they leave the room, evil things. Who plots your downfall, who wants you to be destroyed. That's an unpleasant thing. And Jesus knows that experience. It's actually even worse because David, who wrote the psalm, sort of kind of deserved it. He got himself into this mess because of his own terrible actions, and then someone plots his life. And he acknowledges that even in the psalm. He says, Lord, I'm guilty, but still protect me. For Jesus, even worse, because he's not guilty. He's not done anything to deserve it. And still, Judas wants him dead, or at least wants the money that he'll get from him being dead. And Jesus finds that very hard. But then finally, here's the thing that I think will make you love Jesus. Jesus knows about it, and it scares him and troubles him. And yet, he goes through with it. Deliberately. Verse 27, no one else understands, but he says to Judas, what you're going to do, do quickly. Let's get this done. Go and betray me. Let the soldiers come. Let them try me in a fake trial. Let them put a crown of thorns on my head and spit on me and mock me. Let them nail me to a cross. Let me die and know what it is to be forsaken by God. It's not that he got in too deep and didn't realize it. Was he knew exactly what was going to happen, and he allows it. Because when Jesus makes the offer, come into the light, he is willing to pay for the consequences of your darkness and my darkness. He's not saying, if you're a really good person, join me, and if you're a bit dodgy, you better slip into the shadows. He's saying, if you've done a lot of messed up stuff, join me, and I'm willing to go and pay on the cross. I'm scared about it. It's going to be very costly, but I'm going to go. And so you can come into the light, and you can be, we saw this last week, you can be forgiven and cleansed of whatever you've done. There's no need to do a Judas. Maybe someone here thinks I've like blown it so badly that kind of what's the point now? No one's ever gone that far. And Jesus' death offers a way back, except for the person who prefers the darkness rather than the light. Don't do a Judas. If you're an insider, only the Lord knows whether you're about to slip into being an outsider. Nobody else here will know. But you know, and God is urging you today, don't do a Judas. If you're just starting at university, be careful. I remember when I moved, I'd done my undergraduate degree, and I moved up to Yorkshire for further studies. And I remember thinking, nobody in Yorkshire knows I'm a Christian. No one's going to know if I don't go to church. No one's going to know if I slip into the wrong kinds of things. And it felt like I was about to walk a tightrope without a safety net. And I thought, I need to get a safety net. I need to find a church and a church family and people who will look out for me, because I'm at risk. And I need to come into the light and get people to keep me in the light. Don't do a Judas, but do praise the Lord Jesus, who went deliberately to his death for us. We got some questions. We always put coffee questions at the bottom of the sheet. The idea is that when we eat cake and drink coffee afterwards, that we keep chatting about the sermon. But today, it just occurred to me, you may not want to chat to somebody about it. It might be a thing to talk about with the Lord yourself in quiet. Maybe there's business that you want to do with God. So why don't take the coffee questions and make them at home in my bedroom questions, perhaps, for this week. I'm going to leave a pause, and then we're going to pray together.